This is CKCU Literary News. Here's your host, Hans-George Ruprecht.
Good morning. My guest today is Ruben Friedman, the author of Our Family Holocaust Chronicle, part one of which has recently been published under the title Running for Their Lives. Ruben Friedman, it is a privilege and an honor to have you on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Born in a DP camp, that is, in a camp for displaced persons, for former inmates of the Nazi German concentration camps, you grew up in Toronto and are now living in Ottawa. Holding an academic degree in Russian and French languages and literatures, you have also earned a master's degree of linguistics and a diploma of speech pathology.
Yes.
So we have something in common, right?
That's right.
We are interested in languages.
Absolutely.
Good to see this woman. Your distinguished career in public service, your work in senior positions in Jewish community organizations at the national and local levels, in particular as manager of the Against Prejudice program for the Jewish Family Services of Ottawa, your contribution to the Jewish-Christian Dialogue of Ottawa, and I believe your leading role, for a time at least, as chair of the Holocaust Education Committee of Ottawa. Well, you're admirable for sure, most meritable service, including your work as an appointed member of the board of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, may have something to do with the Holocaust Chronicle of your family, the first part of which, as I just said, has been published under the title Running for Their Lives. But there may be perhaps another motivation for having undertaken this extraordinary project. Could you talk about this?
I think the primordial motivation is coming to terms with my own identity, fulfilling my sense of obligation that this story has to be told, that by telling this story, I help people understand that my parents, who in some ways were just ordinary human beings, yet still were valid survivors of the Holocaust, that they went through much in order to survive and eventually to bring myself and my brother into this world. And I guess my book is a tribute to them and an attempt to come to terms with how I myself have become who I am today.
Now, at this time of the year, we are remembering and honoring the victims and survivors, as you just said, of the Holocaust. But I'm wondering, what is your take at this annual event from the vantage point of your experience, your insight into your family history? How does your understanding of what you just said add to the educational process in which you are so personally involved?
Part of what is in the book and part of what I learned is how genocide aimed at one particular group can nevertheless desensitize those who are carrying it out into carrying out mass murders of many kinds, many crimes against humanity, wherein many human beings are affected, not just the people who were first targeted. So there's a twofold purpose to this day. First, to remember that the motivation for the genocide was to murder the Jews of the world. And second, to understand how that motivation can trickle into and affect the psyche of the murderers to the extent that it desensitizes them to the value of human life in general.
Please tell us, if you would, about your family history? Actually, going back to when? Do you know that?
I only have information that goes back to the mid to late 19th century. I don't have any information that goes back further than that at this time. My cousin, who went to Warsaw and to Radom to trace these roots further, found it very difficult to find the kind of information that would allow us to trace our tree back further. In any case, I come from a family that has lived in an urban setting since at least the middle to the late 19th century. By the 1930s, Radom, where my parents lived, was a city of 100,000. So they did not come from any small town or shtetl, although I am familiar with that, as many of my friends and my wife's family do come from that background. I just wanted to add that there was a kind of a sophistication in that environment that wasn't necessarily present everywhere.
How did the invasion of Poland and Russia bring about a change with which we are still having problems in understanding its gravity? You mentioned it was an urban environment, but this, what is called Yiddish land, was a broad kind of context of cultural similarity, solidarity. I am thinking of Sholem Yankev Abramovich, his famous novel, Das kleine Menschele, the little person, Isaac Bashevis Singer, and of course the work of Marc Chagall. Now, tell me a little bit how you assess that, what happened.
The invasion of Poland was simply a step in something that had begun earlier. The virus of anti-Semitism was spreading throughout Western Europe and indeed throughout the world. And it's clear that many people throughout Western and Eastern Europe had an animus towards Jews, not necessarily strong enough to kill them, but certainly strong enough to wish them ill, to wish that Jews should suffer. Should not, as they say, stick their heads up too high. This was a common attitude throughout. So when the Nazis arose and invaded Poland, they basically gave that feeling an excuse to come out even more strongly. It gave people who felt that feeling a greater encouragement to act on it. And it appealed to the worst elements in these populations, and let them become as the ones who controlled the fates of the Jews and of their own peoples. So it aroused something which I don't know if we've ever been able to quiet down.
This sounds like a realistic or pessimistic assessment. What could we do about that?
The only thing that we can do about it is to continue to speak up when we see things that indicate that these feelings are being acted on more and more. We have to speak out against it. The actions of the government of France to speak out against the actions of those who claim only to be protesting against power, but who use the Jews as a symbol for power, and thus awakening again the whole anti-Semitic mythos that the Jews control everything. This is the kind of thing that we have to be very strong about. We can't let people just get away with it. In the United States, there's an enormous amount of freedom of expression. And in Canada, there's a lot of freedom of expression. But there's a line that is drawn, and when people say things in public, they're called out on it. When they say things that cross the line, they're called out for what they said. It doesn't just pass unnoticed. Whereas in many of these countries of Europe, people say these things and no one reacts at all.
I think your family's experience upon the arrival of the SS in Poland is in fact a case in point. Would you say that their awareness of the first symptoms of that, what will happen, is clearly identifying the kinds of things for which one should watch out? Maybe you would like to give us a little bit of a context of a passage you would like to read to us from your book.
Well, when the SS came in, they basically empowered local thugs to participate in anti-Semitic acts. They would pay young Poles, and in some cases even Jewish children, to help identify who Jews were. Because in many ways, when the Germans came into Radom, they couldn't always tell who was Jewish and who wasn't. So they needed the assistance of the local population in order to do that. So that was the sliver of the beginning of the kind of appeal that helped transform a kind of passive anti-Semitism into something that was much more active and dangerous. And these are the kinds of things we should be constantly on the lookout for. When people in power, people of responsibility, pass over anti-Semitic comments and gestures, that's when we are in danger of encouraging anti-Semitism. And of course, the same principle applies to any group in society. If one passes over these comments and these gestures and lets them pass by as if they were ordinary business, one gives them credibility and validity. And that's a very dangerous thing for us to do.
Let's listen now to a passage from your book.
The streets were again largely empty. If Jewish men went out, they generally stuck to side streets and alleys to avoid as much as possible any contact with the Germans and especially the SS. It was in this atmosphere of increased fear and uncertainty that my father Nuchem visited his brother and sister-in-law. "You have to listen to me. These SS beasts will do anything. All of us are in increased danger of being killed. Our friend Chaim was taken in one of these sweeps and told me that they shot two Jews for looking surly. They will kill us for nothing." Moshe, his brother, looked at him, at his wife, and then at his children, sleeping in the back of their small apartment. "Brother, I know we are facing danger, but think of the danger we will be facing with two young children. How will we be able to hide young children who continue to speak to us in Yiddish? It's impossible. And we certainly aren't leaving the children here. All we can do is hope. Hashem will help us." When he said this, the adults smiled ruefully. None of them really believed it, but it was somehow a comforting thing to say, and that in itself felt comical. Nuchem soon stopped smiling. "Moshe, I don't know how to do it yet, but we must plan for it. I tell you, worse things are coming. I just heard today that the Russians have invaded eastern Poland, September 17th, in keeping with the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. The Polish army is done for. We must get out of here. Until the formal establishment of the General Gouvernement, movement of Poles between Nazi-occupied and Soviet-occupied territories was relatively free. They discussed and argued, but to no avail. Nuchem could not convince his brother and sister-in-law that running away was their only way to survive. They persisted, foolishly, in having hope. At the Yom Kippur services at the main synagogue, the SS entered and ordered the services halted while they went to the Ark and took out all the Torah scrolls. These they later desecrated.
Thank you.
How did your family actually survive?
Basically, because my father was very paranoid about the coming of the Nazis and what they might do, he had the urge to flee. He communicated that urge to his girlfriend, then wife, and to her brother and his wife, and to a few others, and they fled Nazi-occupied Poland into Soviet-occupied Poland. Now, many people were afraid of going into Soviet-occupied Poland because the Soviet Union posed its own dangers and risks, but these were motivated by political considerations and not by race or religion. At least, that's the way they perceived it at the time.
To give us a little background information, why political considerations? On the Russian side. Huh?
Yeah, the Russians were well known to oppose any nationalism in any ethnic group under its control because that nationalism threatened the hegemony of the Russians in the Soviet Union. So that's number one. Number two, they were also concerned about anyone who opposed Stalin's approach to communism. So they were very suspicious of foreign communists. They were suspicious of a lot of people. And a lot of people suffered for that, including Jews who came in to the Soviet Union, but also including Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, white Russians, you name it. People who were deported to Siberia and to the labor camps. These weren't not death camps, but a lot of people died in them anyway.
Could you tell us one or two episodes from your family history, how they managed?
The main principle, I think, was the issue of running when danger came close. So, and to work hard, to continue to work hard, to take every day as it came, not to plan for the long term, but to face the situation that you were dealing with, to go to the coal mines and work in the coal mines when that was what was called for, to run away from the city that you were living in because the German army was likely to approach, and then to flee into the mountains in Georgia or to the Far East in Siberia, or finally, to take up arms and participate in helping to resist the invasion. So these are all the methods that my family used to survive. And, in the end of it all, when you read all the stories of people who survived, and even my own parents' story, you come to appreciate the value of luck.
With my last question, I should like to return to my introductory remarks and let me put it this way. To what extent did your full knowledge of your parents' wartime experience and their escape from death during the Holocaust influence your sense of identity? You referred to this earlier. Moreover, in what way did this knowledge, this awareness, help you or force you to conduct your life in a certain way?
It affected me all through my life, first indirectly, because I had no knowledge of the Holocaust when I was younger.
How come?
My parents didn't talk about it. The way I learned about the Holocaust and its effects was through my brother, who was born in 1942. So he was much more aware of these things, and he communicated them to me, not directly, but the instructions he gave me about the necessity to fight people who were constantly trying to beat me up, about the necessity of being careful in public and to look around you on the street, to always check who was behind you, who was beside you, who was in front of you. He communicated to me the danger of being Jewish in my environment. And this was not in Poland.
This was in Toronto.
Downtown Toronto.
Right.
Where, as late as 1970, people were beaten up and given concussions, beaten up by people with baseball bats on Toronto Island. So the danger was not imaginary. And he changed my name because my name, Reuben, sounded too Jewish for him. And when he called me in for supper, he wanted to call me by another name. So he said, from now on, I'm calling you Norm. And that was my name until I was 16.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. How could one purchase your book? I think you have a page on Facebook. Tell me how people can get your book.
I think the best way is to contact me at rubenathome@gmail.com. Just email me at rubenathome@gmail.com and let me know of your interest, and I'll take care of the rest.
I understand. You just told me this, that the second part is work in progress, pretty advanced. When do you think you will have finished this work in progress?
This work in progress, which is called Fitting into Toronto, will be finished in the next month or so. And it is in that one where I detail the downstream effects of my parents' constant flight from danger, the fear that they felt and that I was communicated to me, and at the same time their belief that there are good people in every nation, that not everyone of any particular background is evil just because of that background. And those are the kinds of lessons they stress to me, and above all, the need to go on.
Ruben, I would like to thank you very much for this interview, and I wish you good continuation with your work as a writer, and maybe other books are still in the making.
I have at least 4 or 5 others.
Wonderful. So we will talk again, and good luck with it.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
That was CKCU Literary News, brought to you by CKCU FM 93.1, the community-based campus radio of Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. We can be heard worldwide. Simply go to http://carleton.ca/litnews/ for streaming and podcast. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter under CKCU Lit News in one word. Thanks for listening.